Did you miss us? A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman is back to carry on working its way through every single produced by Saw. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au, and this is a big episode for my co-host Matthew Denby. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Gavin. Hope you're feeling better. Gavin's had COVID, unfortunately.
Yes, that's what I did in my 3 weeks off.
So, Gavin, that's right. This is the concluding chapter of one of my favourite Saw acts, unfortunately. We've got a couple of great interviews to help tell that particular story. But first, let's start with another one of those curious singles that might have said Saw on the packet, but the record inside didn't necessarily live up to the advertising.
That's right. We're talking about A Walk in the Park, the 87 mix by Nick Straker. Let's have a listen to that. Released in August 1987, that was A Walk in the Park by Nick Straker, which was a remix of a song that had started out being performed by the Nick Straker Band in 1979. It was that group's debut single and had reached number 20 in the UK. Let's have a quick listen to the original version. So, Matt, what do you make of that song? Kind of disco meets new wave, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, it's something from the end of disco in 1979, but also a bit of new wavy vibes coming through there, a bit of a hint of what was to come in the 80s, especially with those vocals and those quirky lyrics, you know, a walk in the park, a trip in the dark. I was actually reading through the lyrics. They're quite a strange little trip. I think it's a bit of an early glimpse of what was to come. I really like the original. I think the remix was a nice little update.
So, yeah, the Nick Straker Band carried on after that first hit without much further success until about 1984, and their final single was a cover of It Only Takes a Minute, or maybe it was Nick Straker on his own by then. Anyway, when A Walk in the Park was remixed and put out again in 1987, it was just under the name Nick Straker, but it found its way to PWL because A, PWL was, you know, bigger than Ben-Hur at this point, and because a certain Mr. Pete Hammond was actually once a member of the Nick Straker Band. So it made sense for him to work his magic with it, and he did, didn't he, Matt?
Yeah, he certainly did. There was a historical connection there, obviously, that was begging to be utilised. Pete Hammond being the brilliant remixer that he is, he was the one to call, wasn't he? So let's have a listen to what Pete had to say about this remix.
The guy who publishes the track, Paul Linton, he was badgering me to do a remix of it because he was quick to latch onto anything that was really happening. I engineered the original, and a lot of the production, to be honest, ideas were on it were mine, but I didn't get any production credit. There was this guy called Jeremy who was completely mad, but he worked for a record company, and he heard the demo and he came budging in and said, I'm producing it, and it needs a different introduction, because it had a slow introduction, the original version. And we had real, I walked out the studio, I couldn't work with him at one point, but anyway, that's the old record. And then I was, Paul Linton got me to do it again, and that's what we did. I just remixed it, but they wanted the Saw name on it, as everybody did, you know, in those days. Just like a Gucci watch, isn't it, or Calvin Klein underpants, whatever else. They had nothing to do with it, nothing whatsoever. Poetic license, which wasn't doing my future any good, because it just meant that I was tied in PWL. I couldn't go away from PWL because no one knew me. It's only in these days that people know me, since the advent of Facebook and everything.
Well, there we go. The same old story that we've heard a number of times now. Pete Hammond doing a remix and Saw getting the branding on it. But actually, Pete Hammond did get a credit as well. The credit is produced by Pete Hammond and Saw. And, you know, as we'd go on, that would change to Pete Hammond and Pete Waterman. When PWL remixed Desireless's Voyage Voyage, that was credited to Pete Hammond and Pete Waterman instead of Saw. So I guess it was a bit of a transition for Pete getting his due credit. I like this update. It reminds me a lot of the high energy Holy Trinity, Love and Devotion, Boom Boom, Male Stripper from 1987, that very latter day high energy sound. It fit in well with 1987. It didn't do particularly well in the UK. It only got to number 82. And yeah, as Matt, you said, you didn't mind it, did you?
Pretty good. Nothing spectacular, but a nice little diversion.
Indeed. It's another one of those oddities in the Saw discography. Okay, shall we get on with this episode's important business? Matt, over to you.
Yes, we've got the final ever single single that Saw did with Dead or Alive. It really is the end of an era. This is the fourth track lifted from the Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know album. Let's have a listen to I'll Save You All My Kisses. Not many have got what it might take to keep me. I'll save you all my kisses. Right, that was I'll Save You All My Kisses, released in October of 87. It didn't reverse the fortunes of the band after the failure of Hooked on Love, with the track only reaching 78 in the UK and 47 in Australia. What did you think of this song, Gavin?
I really like this song, and I think it's an underrated single in Dead or Alive's discography. It reminds me of kind of like a fanfare, that kind of sound that plays throughout it. You know, I find it quite exciting. I like it more than Hooked on Love. I like it more than My Heart Goes Bang. Get Me to the Doctor. I think it's, well, I don't know that it should have done much better, but I would have liked to have seen it do much better.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the momentum had gone after the band had failed to promote Hooked on Love. You know, once the momentum of an album campaign slows down, it's very hard to pick it up again. So unfortunately, I think it was kind of doomed because of the single that came before it. But again, it's a fan favorite. It's something a bit different. But you know who wasn't particularly a huge fan of this single? That was one of the people who wrote it. Pete Burns. He told Maurice Roberto in an interview for Melbourne's Beat magazine in 97 that he didn't want this song released as a single. Quote, I'll Save You All My Kisses was the record company's idea. I wrote the song and I sung the song, but I didn't think it was right for our market. The record company in those days used to run with anything that deviated from the formula that we were very confident about. So that was their choice. And I have to say that although I suffered career-wise, I was very glad that it went badly wrong. Any song that anybody has chosen for us went badly wrong. Gavin?
Oh, Pete shooting himself in the foot yet again.
Yeah, well, he certainly marched to the beat of his own drum, didn't he? And that was very evident when you watched the video for this song. This stands out as probably Dead or Alive's gayest video ever, and it was also kind of out of step with the trends that were happening in music that year. Open homosexuality and gender ambiguity were both largely gone from the charts by 87, unlike just a few years earlier when they were everywhere. Even former superstar Boy George was really struggling at this point in the UK. There was a general tone of increasing social conservatism in pop music at the time. Maybe that was fueled by the media-generated AIDS backlash. Some people think that's what that was all about. Do you remember that change in music, Gavin?
I don't know that I was that conscious of it at the time, but yeah, I mean, a few years earlier in 1984, there was Frankie Goes to Hollywood, there was Marilyn, there was Culture Club, there was Bronski Beat, lots of really out, proud groups. And by 1987, as you say, that wasn't the case anymore. The video for I'll Save You All My Kisses, I don't know that it struck me as particularly gay at the time, but I've watched it again this week and, you know, Steve Coy walking up and down, slamming that baseball bat into his hand, very suggestive.
Yeah, and all those models, those male models climbing up the chain link fence, you know, like rabid dogs trying to get a piece of Pete Burns. It was very in your face. I loved it at the time.
Definitely a changing of the times.
Yeah, well, this record also felt like the end of the chapter where Saw had been working with sort of, I don't know, edgy, queer or underground dance acts, or even just acts who mostly wrote their own material. And it started the dawn of an era with Saw where they were sort of producing more tightly controlled and homogenized acts aimed squarely at a teenage audience. Pete Burns was left feeling pretty bitter about this transition. As the 80s rolled on, the sound that he'd first begged Saw to do was soon being fronted by acts like Kylie and Jason, and there was really nowhere else for him to go in the UK in terms of the music scene. He gave us a sense of how he was feeling about that period during a tour in 97 in Australia. This is where he famously called Kylie, and I quote, a frock on a midget. We're very lucky that we did get permission to share one of Pete's interviews from that tour. In 1997, he had a great chat with Sveta Gilliman, who went on to become quite a famous club DJ here called DJ Sveta. Let's have a listen to what Pete had to say about this time with Saw and how they and pop music as a whole changed, at least in his mind, for the worse.
Unfortunately, when we started our sound, especially with the Spin Me Round success, the producers we were working with then, who didn't invent our sound, Stock Aitken and Waterman, they didn't invent our sound. We went with it completed. We only went to them because the record company don't trust a band to go into the studio without a producer. They took our sound and just basically wheeled it off with a load of other imbeciles, and that makes me a bit sour. It is now, as I say, 17 years doing this in the business, darling. I'm starting to find the actual concept of other artists coming along with the song written for them, the production done for them, everything done for them. They're clogging up the arteries of the industry, and it makes it very, very difficult for other people to break through who've actually worked on it. It's, you know, the thing that I find particularly offensive at the moment from Australia is, you know, the likes of Gina G and, you know, when Kylie was big and Jason Gonigan or Jason Donovan or whatever, you know, I found them really offensive because they polluted the music industry. And of course, record companies are largely like computers. They've got no heart or soul about the work. They just want something that's easy. So they go out with a producer, have dinner, you know, give them a backhander, say, can you write a song for this imbecile? We'll milk them dry and throw them in the bin. And they expect every other act that comes along to be like that. I read a piece in one of your Australian magazines the other day, and I can't quote it exactly, but it was saying, you know, Gina G's come back to her hometown, and she's no pop puppet. She chooses her own hairstyles and decides on what she's going to wear. It's the music industry, for God's sake. It's not Panto. I find that, you know, a bit sorry, and it's not that I'm coming across as a bitch about it. I just don't want anything to do with that type of act. And I do really think there is a place for the Gina G's and the Kylie Minogues. In my mind, it's down the toilet. But in the general public's mind, it's just good time music. I just don't want to be... It's not that I want all the credit, you know, for we do everything ourselves. I just wish the people behind the scenes would realise that we do it all ourselves and then, you know, give us a certain amount of respect.
Now, that interview can only have come from 1997 with all those references to Gina G, can't it?
That's right. Ooh, are indeed.
But it's true. And we'll hear that with the next song we talk about in this episode. It was the end of, you know, the very end of Saw's high energy period, really, with this song before they moved into more of a Eurobeat sound. So it was definitely not only the changing of the guard in terms of, you know, queer acts, but also in the type of music that Saw was putting out.
Well, leaving Saw was not the end for Dead or Alive. In 1988, they released the Nude album, which was self-produced. The lead single from that album was Turn Around and Count to Ten. Let's have a listen.
Now, Matt, we've talked about Dead or Alive's non-Saw output in the bonus material for episode 3 way back at the start of the podcast, so we're not going to go into Nude and the follow-up album Fan the Flame in great detail, but it would be remiss of us not to talk about it a little bit. So give us the nutshell of your opinion on Nude and then talk us through Fan the Flame, which followed that up.
Yeah, I often say Nude was the best Saw album that they never made. It is so, so, so reverential of the Saw sound. Probably Pete wouldn't want me calling it that, but that's what it was. It could have been produced by Saw, and it's so very good. Now, Mike Percy and Tim Lever left the band after the first single. The album did extremely well in Japan, and the singles did great on the US dance chart. The album also spawned two charting singles here in Australia, but it completely died in the UK. That plunged the band into an extended period of obscurity in their home country. There wasn't another record until 1990 when the band produced Fan the Flame Part 1. They left High Energy behind with this record. They produced a much more mellow, lush, early 90s house sound. They did it with collaborator Peter Oxendale. He was a new addition to the mix. It didn't restore their fortunes, unfortunately. It was only ever released in Japan, where it spawned a couple of hits, including Your Sweetness Is Your Weakness. Let's have a listen to that now.
So there we go, a snippet from Fan the Flame there. And as I said, if you want to hear us talk more about Dead or Alive's non-Saw and non-PWL output, head to the bonus material from episode 3. Now, Matt, what happened next?
Well, the unthinkable happened. After a period of 3 years, Dead or Alive resurfaced. And where did they resurface? Out of all places, PWL Studios.
No.
Well, I could never have predicted that at the time. It came as quite the surprise for me. Pete told Maurice Oberto in that interview for Beat, and I quote, like like suckers for punishment, when we extricated ourselves from our deal with CBS Worldwide, PWL came and offered us an extremely lucrative deal. They agreed to everything we wanted. They really wanted us for some reason because we were the sound that put them on the map. Dead or Alive also said in an interview at the time that they were really attracted to PWL because unlike CBS, it was a small team. They didn't feel they were going to get lost. They felt with a small team behind them, they'd get pushed. They wouldn't get forgotten. And that's what inspired them in part to sign with PWL.
So this is where our next guest, Barry Stone, comes into the picture. Not only is Barry Stone half of Jules and Stone, and these days the Alias, but he's a Saw and Dead or Alive superfan, just like me and Matt. And he got a job at PWL in 1989. When we get to our 1989 episodes, we'll let him tell the story of how he landed at PWL. But we are skipping ahead a bit now to 1993. He was still there, and he was there when Dead or Alive were coming back to work at PWL. So let's hear from Barry now as he tells the next stage of this story.
I was an absolutely massive fan of his from the first time I saw Spin Me on Top of the Pops. I saw like 60 seconds of it, probably much like your experience, but it just did something to me. Yeah, I mean, I actually was quite obsessed with him and the band. It was kind of like an equal thing between Dead or Alive and Stark Aitken Waldman, really. I was obsessed with each of them. But one of the reasons I wanted to work at PWL was to meet Dead or Alive. That was like one of my main aims. And so by the time I got there in 89, they'd long gone. They were making albums elsewhere, but I wasn't too disheartened. But as it turned out, I hung on in there long enough to actually, by the time they came back, I'd actually learned some skills.
You're at PWL and you hear on the grapevine that Dead or Alive are coming in to make new music. What were your thoughts?
Well, I remember around the time myself and Jules had first started doing these remixes together, Pete took us aside one night and asked us, he told us that Pete and Dead or Alive might be coming back and what we thought and whether there was a place for them in the music scene at that time. And I remember thinking, well, yeah. And I remember, I don't know why, but I thought like Capella's Take Me Away would be like a kind of an area where they would fit. And after we had this conversation, I remember saying to Jules, we should write a song for them for when they come back to have something, you know, ready. And so we did. So we wrote a song for them. I was doing an artist thing at the same time. And I loved this song so much that it became a song that I was going to use. Then we were told that they were going to come in and work with Mike. And then I kind of remember, maybe I knew which day it was going to be that he was due to come in. And I was like, kind of, you know, walking past reception, maybe a bit more than normal. I was like, you know, waiting to see. And and then I saw him. He was in a red Vivienne Westwood bondage suit. And we locked eyes on each other briefly. So yeah, so that was the first time I saw Pete. I wasn't involved in that session. Julian was, though. And that was, they wrote a song with Mike called I Can't Break It to My Heart. I think that is the reason why I've heard Mike talk about this recently. That's why it kind of came to blows with Pete and why he kind of left in the end due to the song splits and the fact that Mike didn't feel it was very fair that he was doing all the heavy lifting and the songwriting. And then it went quiet for a while.
This was the project that broke Stock and Waterman, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that Spin Me was the one that started them off. And then this one is where it all kind of came to blows. But I'd imagine it was... I'd imagine it was coming to the end anyway. It was just, like you say, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Great summary there from Barry. And Matt, you've got some quotes from Pete Burns and Mike Stock that back up that version of events, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. So Pete Burns said in the 2001 Hit Factory TV documentary, and I quote, Waterman was still carrying on trying to make things look okay. Mike Stock was still there, but the atmosphere was so bad, we just didn't want to go into that studio. It wasn't very productive to any creativity. And Mike Stock went a lot further in his book. He talked about how he was really upset about the song splits, as Barry mentioned. The way that Pete Waterman structured the deal with Dead or Alive was that Pete Waterman, would get 25% of all song royalties. From the band, Pete Burns and Steve Coy would each get 25%, and Mike Stock would get 25%. So a four-way split. This did not please Mike Stock, who felt that he was carrying most of the weight in the songwriting, and he went to Pete Waterman's office to have it out with him. Quote, I called a meeting with Pete and I suggested I receive 50% of the publishing royalties for these new songs. I suggested that he could have the other 50% and split it between himself and the others. Pete didn't take kindly to this suggestion, stating that he would never be be a junior partner with me, even though that wasn't what I asked for. I was not prepared to go with anything less than a 50-50 split. I hadn't meant to put Pete down, but it turned into a blazing row with both of us screaming and shouting. Finally, I said to Pete, I'll be on my way. And Saw was finished, just like that.
And so that's the end of the podcast, everybody. No. We will obviously reference this event when we get to 1993 in our journey. But yeah, it's interesting to get a glimpse of how things ended here when we're talking about Dead or Alive being back at PWL. So Mike Stock and Dead or Alive may not have carried on working together, but Barry Stone was waiting right there to step into the breach. And as you said, he had a slice of Italo dance in mind for the direction Dead or Alive could take. Let's have a listen to Capella's Take Me Away, which he talked about in his interview. Here it is.
And the fingerprints of that track are all over the album that came out of these sessions. But before that album ever came out, there was a lead single. It was decided that Dead or Alive would come back with a cover to try and overcome some of the prejudice that had built up in the industry against the band. It was decided that they would record the old David Bowie classic Rebel Rebel, but it wasn't going to be a straight cover. The reference track for this was going to be Open Up by Left Field. That is a classic early 90s dance track. Its heaviness, its brutality, would be a great sort of reference point to bring Dead or Alive up to date and re-enter the British music scene. Let's have a listen to Open Up, and then let's have a listen to Dead or Alive's version of Rebel Rebel.
That was Rebel Rebel there by Dead or Alive, although they were calling themselves International Crisis when that single came out, but we'll explain that in a little while. For now, let's hear from Barry, who produced that track.
I remember being told, I don't know whether it's by Pete or David Hells, that Pete and Steve were going to come back and they were going to do an album and they wanted me to help them with it. So I was like, right. Anyways, we ended up doing this in Ian's old room. It started off being just a cover of Rebel Rebel. I think Steve came in with, in those days, a lot of floppy disks and of stuff he'd been working on at home, and gave them to me to kind of start working on Rebel Rebel and a few others. And obviously I was familiar with the catalog, and I kind of recognized some of these tracks as being tracks that were on the Fan the Flame album. Like Total Stranger was one of them, but it was kind of like he was asking me to just kind of rejig them and just kind of make them sound more contemporary. And all the while we were like kind of working on Rebel Rebel as well, getting that ready. And I still hadn't met Pete at this point because we were kind of getting the tracks ready before Pete came in. And then I guess at some point it was ready and he came in to do his vocal. He was just so funny, and we got on like a house on fire, and it was very, you know, he did the vocal very easily. I did some backing vocals on it. Steve did some backing vocals on it as well. And I think the only thing was Pete had written a new verse and we had to scrap that because Mr. Bowie didn't give his permission for these new lyrics that Pete had written, which was fine because then Pete used them on Cleopatra, the track later on. But again, it was just one of those things where I had been such a big fan. It just, it didn't seem real for a while. And there was no pressure to get it done by a certain time. I think Sony Japan may have been funding it. I'm not quite sure how the deal was structured, because obviously they were recording at PWL and PWL put out the Rebel Rebel thing. I didn't for sure know it was going to turn into a whole album, but it was just exciting to not only be kind of working on that with them on this Rebel Rebel single, but also like singing on the record and then having it come out. And I went down to the video as well. Yeah, it was a really exciting time.
For Pete being back in PWL, did you get the sense that was difficult in any way?
I didn't get that sense. I mean, it was weird because I remember once Steve had some camcorder footage of them in the studio. I don't know whether they're doing Mad Bad or Youthquake, but Pete looked how he looked then, obviously, in the camcorder. And I remember watching it and being so kind of like, fanboyish about it, even though I had been working with him for weeks and months. But they were separate, I guess, in my mind. They were different. The kind of the Pete I was a fan of obviously looked very different. So yeah, I was like, so this camcorder footage was just like, you know, blowing my mind. I was like getting to see the Pete that I'd like idolized as a kid, kind of behind the scenes, if you like. But he had a whale of a time when he came to the studio, when he did come in. Yeah, he did.
How great are those recollections? Well, as Barry mentioned, David Bowie was not happy at all that Pete wrote new verses for Rebel Rebel. Not only did he ask that Pete remove those verses from the final version, which he did, he also requested that Pete not release the record at all. What a burn is that, Gavin?
Yeah, that must have come as a bit of a crushing blow to Mr. Burns.
Yeah, that's right, because Pete did grow up worshipping David Bowie. But he was not particularly conciliatory in regards to Bowie's request. He did say at the time, and how should I put this in sort of more delicate words than Pete used? He did suggest in the press that David Bowie could go and perhaps pursue a romance with a canine.
Oh, Pete. He certainly had a way with words, didn't he?
He did. And he had a way with words when he spoke to Sveta Gilliman, because he spoke at length about the decision to record Rebel Rebel and also to release it under the new name International Crisis, which some of the marketing staff at PWL felt was necessary because it was believed at the time that Dead or Alive were such a stained brand in the UK, they had to start with a new title.
When we did the David Bowie and Blondie song, it was mainly because when a group who actually do their own music and produce it go into the studio, they're playing about with the controls and they're playing about with the keyboards and stuff. And you sort of just, it's in a very rock tradition, you start to jam on somebody else's song. And if it turns out good, you complete it and think, right, well, we'll take the sounds that we demoed on this song and we'll use it on our own song, etc. But when we recorded this album, we just signed a worldwide deal with PWL Records, which was Pete Waterman's label. We'd done our playing about in the studio with the Debbie Harry song and the David Bowie song, and then the record label started to fall to bits. So consequently, we didn't have enough time in the studio to continue composing our own music, so they were actually put on as sort of album fillers. Although I like them, you know, doing his Rebel Rebel, it just seemed appropriate at the time because we had the dressy up movement and all those things going on in London clubland. But it certainly wasn't engineered as a commercial success because it consequently didn't have any real commercial success. We recorded it under the name of International Crisis because we thought we'd get it on the radio and people wouldn't recognise it was Dead or Alive because people were saying, oh, your sound's so old-fashioned. And we thought we'd do this song and it might get us on the radio and nobody'd know who it was. But the cat got out of the bag pretty quickly and everybody did, and consequently they didn't play it.
Well, unfortunately, the rebranding exercise did not work in the UK, where Rebel Rebel only made number 76 on the charts. In Australia, where Pete did a lot better with some of his later singles, it was not the case either because it only reached 97. Gavin, what did you think of that?
Well, do you know what? I was a fan of the DNA featuring Jazzy P track Rebel Woman a few years earlier. So I was all Rebel Rebelled out by the time the International Crisis single came out a few years later. I never saw that this was going to be a massive chart hit, but nevertheless, Dead or Alive pressed on with the album project. Barry hadn't been sure that it was going to be an album, but in fact it was, and Nucleopatra was soon born. Let's hear from Barry now talking about how the album came together.
When we got full into the album, my one thing about working with them was I liked the Nude album, but the album after that, Fan the Flame, I wasn't a big fan of, and I didn't like the way his vocal was sounding, because especially on stuff like, you know, My Blue Christmas, and this croonery side to his voice was kind of creeping in. And I'd seen him do some TV shows where it was just him and a piano, and that wasn't the Pete Burns that I was into. So that was my one mission, was to try and make him sound like he did on the earlier Saw albums. I think it was very hard for Steve to try and motivate Pete to actually write. He was very self-conscious and very insecure, really, about his songwriting, I think. And so Steve would get me to rejig these tracks to try and, you know, he'd bring them back to, because earlier in the album, Pete wouldn't come in. It would be Steve that would come in, and then Steve would take stuff back to Pete at home to play him, I think, to try and like inspire him to try and come up with stuff. And when he came back with I'm a Star, I was like, yes, this is the Pete Burns songwriting I really like.
Crashing falls from Liverpool to
Steve was trying to constantly cajole Pete into being kind of creative. There'd be days where like I'd go in and be ready to work and they just wouldn't show up, or Steve might show up but Pete wouldn't, or sometimes Steve mightn't show up. Yeah, it just seemed to go on for quite a while. So I you know, had plenty of time to make it sound good. But then Pete would come in, which is why I think Steve had managed to cajole him into being creative, and he'd come in with a new set of lyrics, like when we do New Cleopatra, and he'd be really kind of inspired, and I want to use this from that record, this from that record, and it was just all systems go. And so yeah, that was exciting, but then there'd be kind of gaps.
As you mentioned, there are a couple of recycles from Fan the Flame. They re-recorded the glam track Sex Drive.
Yes, which I was delighted about. Like I said, when Pete Waterman had mentioned about them coming back, and I thought of this Capella track, you know, other things like Felix, Don't You Want Me, and Glam, Hell's Party had come to mind. I thought, you know, these would be like a good area for Dead or Alive to be in at that time. So when, I'm sure it was Steve, played me the Sex Drive, I was like, and the song, you know, Pete's songwriting is just like, his strength was his, you know, his lyric writing and his melodies, apart from his voice, but it was really evident on Sex Drive. So I was delighted when they said, you know, we were going to rework that, because I love that track and I spent a good amount of time on that one.
So obviously, sadly, there were never any more singles in the UK after Rebel Rebel and the album. To the best of my knowledge, the album didn't come out in the UK until like very recently. It must have been very frustrating to you to have something, you know, an album that you'd been so involved in, and such a good album too, to not have had a commercial release. Do you know why that happened, and what were your feelings about that not happening?
As far as I remember, I don't think I ever expected it to come out in the UK. Like I said, because Sony Japan was paying for it, it was always geared for that market. So I don't know whether I ever had any expectations. I think after Rebel Rebel hadn't done very well, it was probably not a given it would come out in the UK. But also I was just like on cloud nine, having worked with them in the first place, you know. And when it came out in the Japanese territory and they showed me the credits, I was just like, oh wow, yeah, I was well pleased.
You got a rave liner note in there from Pete. That must have been an absolute thrill.
Yeah, it was. They were really supportive of me. Like I said, I'd been kind of pursuing the artist road myself, and they were really supportive. While we were recording the album, I had played some of my stuff to Steve, and he said, oh, Pete's gonna love this. And so the next time Pete was in, he had me play him some of the material. And one of the songs, which is the song I mentioned earlier that I wrote with Julian, it was called Getting Away with Murder. Pete was just like, I want this, I want to do this. And it was so hard, because I was like, that was kind of my track by that point. And I'm thinking about it now, that would have been amazing had he recorded it, but I held on to it with dear life. You know, they were really supportive of me, and like, to give me that credit was super amazing. You know, we used to share stories of, you know, record company woes. You know, I was trying to get a deal, and like, you know, that was a long road, and they would tell me all like the nightmare stories that they'd experienced with A&R and labels. They just, as you've alluded to in previous episodes, you know, they just were not fans of record companies. Yeah, and I remember I was doing like an EPK thing to try and get signed, and a video EPK, and they offered to lend me some clothes for the video, and I ended up wearing that red bondage suit that I saw him wear the first time I saw him. So that was pretty amazing.
I've got to say, there's a nice circularity to that story, all coming back to that red bondage suit.
Yeah, and I actually saw Pete wearing that red bondage suit myself, because when he came to do a signing in Melbourne, I was there and he was wearing that suit.
There we go. It got around, didn't it?
Yeah, well, going back to the mystery of why this album was not initially released in the UK, it turns out the band had a major falling out with Pete Waterman. The band wanted Paul Oakenfold and other outside remixers of the moment to work on the album's next singles. Waterman refused. And we know this because I was able to dig up a copy of Dead or Alive's News International fan club newsletter from the summer of 95, and I'll quote it here. They quote the band as saying this: Waterman wanted to produce future remixes and even write what he described as, quote, a number one single for the band. He never did deliver, write, or produce a, quote, guaranteed number one for any of his artists, and the truth is Pete Waterman is not a producer. Contrary to what everyone thinks, he has never written or produced anything on his own. We therefore decided we had no option but to leave the label. His ego could not take the rejection from us, and the label refused to allow any outside remixes to be involved. Unquote. Gavin, what do you think of that?
I mean, that just sounds like classic Pete and Pete, right? Honestly, they're the frenemies, the love-hate relationship of this journey that we're going on. But despite all those behind-the-scenes bust-ups, Nuclear Petra did come out, as we've said, in Japan. It did come out in Australia. It did quite well in Australia. The band toured here. And again, in that bonus material from Ep 3, we talk a lot about the You Spin Me Round remix that came out around that time as well. So, you know, the project had a welcome reception in certain parts of the world. But Matt, it wasn't the last time that Pete and Pete would collaborate, was it?
After the 2012 Hit Factory live concert, Waterman was inspired to come out of retirement to relaunch Pete Burns as a solo star. The project was never completed after Pete Burns pulled out, unfortunately, and he spoke all about it in an interview with author James Arena in his book, Europe's Stars of 1980s Dance Pop. Quote, Pete Waterman said he wanted me to sound like Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails and that should be the new direction for me. I basically had one day every 2 weeks to write and completely mix a track, and he was going to try and sell it to another record label. It was impossible to do it. Well, I would have loved to have heard that. What about you, Gavin?
Yeah, I think I probably could have given that one a miss, but you know what? Pete Waterman and Pete Burns may not have ended up making sweet music together in the end, but Barry Stone and Pete Burns did get on famously until Pete tragically passed away a few years ago. And you can hear more from Barry about his ongoing relationship with Pete Burns in the bonus material and how that relationship actually helped kickstart his and production partner Julian Gingell's post-PWL career. Barry's going to talk about some of the acts he and Julian have worked with since then. Think Sophie Ellis-Bextor, Rachel Stevens, Adam Rickett, and of course, the big one, Steps. Now, Matt, that brings us to the end of our Dead or Alive journey. Final thoughts? Speak now or forever hold your peace, or, you know, until you bring them up next episode.
Well, my Dead or Alive journey is probably never going to end, I don't think. They were a great pop band who I don't think ever really got enough credit for their role in the development of Saw's sound. Without them, there never would have been that second win for Bananarama, and there probably never would have been a Kylie Minogue either. I think, you know, Dead or Alive were the template for great sort of synthy pop music that Saw made so well. They have two great albums with Saw. They made great records after Saw, including Nuclear Petra. Saw fans, if you've never heard that album, do give it a listen. It's a great piece of mid-90s pop. And I want to thank, finally, Barry for speaking to us, because Barry is a genuine fan of Saw who actually made his dream come true and got to work there and got to work with some of his teenage idols. And thanks again, Barry.
Right. Now, from one of the key artists in the Saw story, we move to another with the latest release from Bananarama. Here is Love in the First Degree. Charting in October 1987, that was Love in the First Degree by Bananarama, which was the second single from Wow, which had actually been released a few weeks earlier. I find it a little bit odd, that timing with that release, Matt, that the second single from an album would come out a few weeks after the album. I would have thought they would have come out on the same day, or the second single would have come out a week or two earlier. And I wonder if that release prevented possibly Love in the First Degree going even higher than its chart position in the UK. Where did it get to in the UK?
Yeah, who knows? It could have got all the way to number one. That is a very strange release strategy from London Records. It got to number three in the UK and also did really well around the world. Number five in Australia, making up for the really disappointing start with I Heard a Rumour Down Under. Got to number nine in Belgium, number six in Ireland, 12 in the Netherlands, 10 in Norway, 10 in South Africa, and a disappointing number 48 in America. I think probably because it was following up I Can't Help It there, which had also not made the top 40. Perhaps if it had been the second single in the US, it would have gone straight up into the top 10 where it belonged.
Yeah, that's right. What were these record companies thinking? I don't know. They've got a perfectly brilliant single on their hands and they go and muck around with release schedules. But yes, number three in the UK, matching the peak of Bananarama's biggest hit to date in the UK, which was Robert De Niro's Waiting. And number three was also the position reached by Help a couple of years later. So three singles by Bananarama peaking at number three. They never got any higher there, despite getting a US and Australian number one with Venus. So this is basically Bananarama's biggest hit in the UK. Yes, tied with two other songs, but you know, it still holds that title.
It's a brilliant track. It was so of the moment, that wonderful Europop sound, fantastic song, so well structured, and the video was fantastic. I remember the first time I ever saw this video played on a show here called Rage. I just loved it. I just raced straight out to get the 12-inch. That wonderful, wonderful record with the amazing B-side, Mr. Sleaze. It's a real high point of Saw's greatest ever run of singles. One of Saw's best ever singles, and definitely one of Bananarama's best ever singles.
This definitely was Saw getting their Europop on. It was the transition, as I mentioned earlier, from that high energy sound into more of a Europop sound. And if you listen carefully, you can hear that it was clearly inspired by Spagna's Call Me, a big hit on the continent and in the UK. Let's have a little bit of a listen to Call Me. Matt, can you hear the similarities there between Call Me and Love in the First Degree?
I definitely can. It's something I picked up at the time. And also, I'm going to mention Dead or Alive already. They also did a ripoff of Spania's Call Me on their Nude album. So I think, you know, when you're on a good thing, run with it. It's great pop. It's such a 1987 sound. It's brilliant.
Another thing that's really interesting about this single is the lyrics. Basically an extended metaphor of judges and juries and being accused and all that kind of stuff. It's quite unlike most Saw song lyrics, which are kind of a bit more general, about general feelings and emotions. This is quite specific in terms of the language used and the description used. And I wonder how much part the Bananarama ladies had in the writing of these lyrics. Obviously, we know they contributed to lyrics probably more so than the music. They sometimes contributed to melodies as well. But to me, this feels like Bananarama had quite a strong influence in the lyrics, because it doesn't feel like Mike Stock's normal lyrics, does it?
No, definitely not. And you know, you have the girls' fingerprints all over the songs from this album, especially their next one after this, but I'll save my commentary until we get to that one. Part of the process of the Wow project was that the guy sent Bananarama away and said, look, come back with a list of song titles and we'll start from there, because they thought that would be a good creative starting point for the album. And we know specifically that Siobhan came up with the title for I Heard a Rumor, which is a brilliant title for a pop song. And I strongly suspect she also had her fingerprints all over this song as well, because as you say, it's not typical Saw fare. It's a collision of, you know, different people coming together and producing something quite unique lyrically.
Indeed. Now, another thing about Siobhan in this song was that she was pregnant in the filming of the video for Love in the First Degree. So no, that wasn't her doing backflips in the video. In fact, I don't think any members of Bananarama were doing gymnastics in that video. There were some body doubles going on there. But yeah, Siobhan was starting this other life. She was living in LA with Dave Stewart by this point. And during the process of making Wow, she wasn't always around. And so we are seeing at this stage, this was the kind of time in Siobhan's life where she was moving on to a new chapter. And Love in the First Degree, in another way, would be the song that would mark the end of Siobhan's time in Bananarama, because the girls would give a memorable performance of the track at the Brit Awards the following year. You've seen that performance, haven't you, Matt?
Yeah, it's an absolute classic, all those half-naked men dancing around on the stage. I think that probably would have turned the stomachs of all the old rock ghouls who were there in the audience, you know, wanting to see, I don't know, whoever it was, Fleetwood Mac or something.
So it was definitely a high point in Bananarama's chart career. It was a high point in their performance career with that dazzling performance at the Brits. But it was a shame that it was also part of the beginning of the end for the first era of Bananarama. drummer. One thing that was kind of instrumental in Siobhan leaving, of course, was her contentious relationship with Saw. Matt, tell us some more about that.
Yeah, the one person that she consistently clashed with was Pete Waterman, who she actually recently claimed she was so annoyed with, she actually demanded that he not be in the studio when she was in there. That's how bad things got. But Pete Waterman was really passionate about these records. He really loved Bananarama, and, you know, we know he was a genuine pop fan and he was emotionally invested in these records, as were the girls. He's actually said that Love in the First Degree was his favorite ever song that he had involvement in, to such an extent that he has claimed repeatedly he wants it played at his funeral. Now, he's made a few claims about his creative involvement here. He said that he came up with the idea for the tune of this song when he woke up one morning with an old song by Bobby Freeman called Tossing and Turning in his head, which he claims was the basis of the tune for this song. Now, both Gavin and I have listened to this song and we cannot hear it at all. Can we, Gavin?
Nope, can't hear it. Pete also says in his book, I Wish It Was Me, that he's the reason Love in the First Degree came out as a single at all. According to him, the band and record company were in two minds about putting it out, and he had to threaten to walk away from the project to ensure it was released as a single. Apparently.
Well, this sort of plays into the notion that Pete Waterman has quite a few sort of, creative memories about some of his involvements. And Sarah Dellen from Bananarama has commented on that as well, about some of the things that he would say about the making of this record and other records. She said, and I quote, "We'd argue about things he'd said in the press. Like, I was lying in the bath and I thought, Love in the First Degree. And it's like, you weren't even there." Bracket laughs. His stories were so hysterical, and as much as he was never fully involved in the writing side, he'd always pop his head around the door with that one great idea to make the track amazing. And I'm absolutely sure, Gavin, that's true. I mean, it's just so good and it's so poptastic. It's one of the high points of all of their careers.
That's right. Now, from Bananarama's joint biggest hit, we come now to a man whose chart fortunes had seen better days. But surely Saw could turn that around, right?
Well, you'd hope so, because this guy was a legend. American soul icon Edwin Starr brought his glorious voice to Saw in 1987, but could they give him a hit? Well, let's take a listen. Let's listen to Whatever Makes Our Love Grow by Edwin Starr, released in October of 87. What a great record that was. Well, unfortunately, it only got to number 98 in the UK. Do you think that's fair, Gavin?
You know, it's interesting that you said that it's such a great record, because I've never really considered this as a great record. I don't hate it. I just don't love it. I own it, because of course I do. But it's never been a song that I've played that much. I think, yeah, he's a great singer, but it just didn't really do it for me. And I'm not entirely sure why, because it's got that, you know, Chicago house sound to it. Maybe it was a few months late with that, and he's got a great soul voice. But yeah, I don't know, maybe it's not a strong enough melody. I don't know what it is. But for me, I don't see this being a massive hit.
Well, maybe it's just not poptastic enough for you, Gavin, because perhaps. This definitely is not first and foremost a pop record. It's a club record with its roots very clearly in Chicago, as you said. I think Love Can't Turn Around is definitely, you know, the inspiration for this record. Perhaps it did come a little late after that whole sort of early run of house hits, and that's why it missed out on the charts. Who can say? But I also think a problem here was that this being a very club-oriented, DJ-oriented record, which was probably never going to get radio play, around this time, Saw had really fallen out with a lot of the serious club DJs. So if those guys weren't going to get behind this record, and it was perhaps too sort of clubby for the radio, what in did they have with this record? And I think it's a real shame because, you know, Edwin is a real legend in music. He had the song War, which was just one of the defining songs of the Vietnam War era, a defining protest record in that sort of turbulent decade. It's a shame that he didn't get to have, you know, a run later on in a genre where his voice was completely well suited, like house. I love this record. I think what I really like about this is that it's so atypical of Saw at the time. It's really sort of, I guess, unusually messy and freewheeling in the way that the vocals are performed. You know, the sax, that's not typical for a Saw record. It's kind of a shame. But when people say, you know, why didn't saw work with more great vocalists. I think we can look at this record and see perhaps why they didn't, because a great vocal can be, you know, a landmark in music, but if it's not going to get played on pop radio, what can you do? Like, when you have a pop star that's marketable to young teenagers like a Kylie, that's a far better bet than sort of taking a punt on a record like this for producers like Saw, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think another thing working against this track was that it had been quite a while since Edwin had had a hit in the UK. His most recent UK successes had been the top 10 hits Contact and HAPPY Radio in 1979. And, you know, he'd had a series of singles on Hippodrome Records in the 80s before he signed to 10 Records for this release. But yeah, he really had been under the radar for a while. Let's have a little bit of a listen to some of his back catalogue. Let's hear a little bit of War and a little bit of Contact, just in case you're unfamiliar with Edwin's work. That was War and Contact by Edwin Starr. And of course, Edwin Starr had appeared on a chart topper recently. He had been one of the vocalists on Let It Be by Ferryade early in the year. Of course, that was produced by Saw as well. Was that where the connection was made with Saw? Did he come and work with them on Whatever Makes Our Love Grow after having recorded on Ferryade? Or was it the other way around? Was he already working with Saw and they said, hey, come and do Ferryade? I'm not sure about the timing of that. But Matt, you've got some interesting insight from Edwin's experience working with Saw, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. He did an interview in 1992 with Blues and Soul magazine, where they asked him about his experience with working with Saw, and he was not happy. Quote, "They were never serious about what they were doing with me. At the time, they'd never had any success with anyone that was an established artist, because their format was foreign to an artist that knows the ins and outs of performing. I mean, you don't call an artist on the day of recording, then show him the song 2 minutes before he walks in the studio, and then guide him through the vocals verbatim. They damn well wanted to treat professionals as novices. Not happy, Gavin."
No, I mean, that does tally with what we've heard about the process Saw went through. But yeah, I think people like Precious Wilson and Edwin Starr, the, you know, these singers who had been around for a long time, I'm surprised that they would have done that with them. But, you know, I guess that was the Hit Factory way.
Well, all artists have their processes. And let's remember that Saw were artists as well. They were well sort of established in their art. They knew what they wanted to do. Perhaps they could have stretched a little for someone like Edwin, but they had their way of working with things. He didn't like the way they worked. Notably, he did not criticize the record, just criticized the process. I'm glad he didn't slag the record off because, as I've just said, I think it's great.
And actually, the record was given a second shot at success in December 1988. It was re-released, but it didn't chart then at all. So yeah, unfortunately, two bites at the cherry, but no hit for Edwin Starr with Whatever Makes Our Love Grow. And that's it for this episode. It's been an odyssey working through, again, a little bit of everything from Saw. And next episode, we're going to have an interesting one. We have the next Rick Astley single, which was an old Ochi Brown track. And we have the next Ochi Brown single, which features Rick Astley. So yeah, some crossover there in the next episode. And that will be out in 2 weeks. We're not going to make you wait 3 weeks again for now. But an interesting thing, Matt, while this episode is released, it will be our 1 year anniversary.
Well, I'm shocked to hear that, Gavin. It really doesn't feel like a year. It feels like maybe 6 months, but you know, time is speeding up, I think.
But thank you to everyone who has listened to us all this time, and even the newcomers. I get messages all the time from someone saying, right, I've just found you and I'm starting the podcast, and then they'll binge it and, you know, listen to 20 episodes in a week. And then it's like, oh, now I've got to wait 2 weeks. So yeah, maybe don't binge too quickly sometimes, but it's great to have people continuing to find this series. And Matt, what's the best way for people to find this series?
Yeah, the best way to help other people find this series is for you to pop on to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, whichever one you use, and give us a star rating, because the star ratings do help other people find us. Please help us out. Also, please talk about us on social media and talk to us on social media. We can be found on ChartBeatsAU on Instagram and on Twitter, and you can find us by searching for ChartBeats on Facebook. You can speak to me on Twitter as well directly. I'm Mr. Matt Denby. Please do drop me a tweet.
Bonus material for this episode is extra from Barry Stone, as I said, when he's going to talk all about his and Julian Gingell's career post-PWL. You can find that at chartbeats.com.au/saw, where you can subscribe for the bonus material. That's it for now. See you all in 2 weeks. Bye, Matt.
See you later, everybody.